Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's getting weird in the Arctic. Climate changing, ice melting, polar bears and grizzlies, confused and interbreeding. More change to come. And in the middle of it stands the musk ox. From Alaska to northern Canada and pockets in Norway, Siberia, the musk ox endures. And it has since the Pleistocene era, almost alone. Its story is more than amazing, including coming back to America through New York Harbor, right past Ellis Island. This hour on Point, the mighty musk ox, the great survivor, and the future of the Arctic. You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Our guide to a little sound of muskox in this hour will be David Attenborough from the great BBC series back in 06, Planet Earth. Here he is introducing the muskox, oxen here, as they grunt and scrape through the Arctic snow.
These giants have the strength to smash through the frozen crust to graze on the vegetation below.
And they are giant. You do not want to mess with them. Another little bit here. A mother muskox chases away an Arctic fox from her newborn calf, very newborn, as the fox tries to scavenge for the placenta.
The muskoxen have recently given birth. For the fox, it's a chance to scavenge. But half a ton of mad, hairy cow is not to be trifled with.
Half a ton of mad, hairy cow, and not just if you're a fox. Here's a video, you can see it at our website, posted on YouTube, of a cameraman shooting, that is, taking film of a muskox. The muskox looks up. This is up on the tundra, checks him out, and charges. You'll hear just a little, check it out online. It's amazing. That is the shouting sound of man in flight from muskox. Muskox, the great survivor. We're going to learn a lot about them in this hour. Can't wait to do it. Joining us right now from Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska, is Jim Lawler. He's a biologist with the National Park Service's Arctic Network, an expert on muskox, knows them very well, up close and intimate. Jim Lawler, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
It's great to have you. We want to hear all about muskox. And with us from New York City is Ross McPhee. He's a curator at the Department of Mammalogy at the American Museum of Natural History, an expert on ancient mammals, mastodons, mammoths, saber-toothed cats, musk oxen. He's also curator of the museum's current Race to the End of the Earth exhibit on the exploration of Antarctica. Ross McPhee, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
We're going to get right out there, sort of in muskoxen territory with Jim in just a second. But remind us, Ross, of the incredible sort of survivor character of this creature. Mastodons gone, woolly mammoth gone, saber-toothed tiger, giant sloth all gone. And the muskox was around then. Give us a sense of just how long this great beast has been around, Ross.
Let me give you some context. The end of the Pleistocene, on the order of 10,000 years ago, witnessed a lot of extinctions, and a lot of those were concentrated in North and South America. There's debate about how many species we're talking about, but it's on the order of 100, and of those, the greater proportion were large, and by large, I mean 100 pounds or better.
Megafauna.
So, megafauna. Some very mega indeed. I mean, you know, you've got the screaming cameraman if he was dealing with an enraged ground sloth.
Much slower.
Lord only knows what it would be like.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, so you had a variety of very large animals, and they all disappeared, of course, with exceptions. And the exceptions that everyone knows about, because they're much more familiar to us, would be things like bears, reindeer, elk, animals like that. But the muskox doesn't have a big fan base, and the reason for that probably is because it's very isolated at high latitudes. So why was it that muskoxen were able to survive? That's a question that I'm sure we're going to get to as we go along, but it's a fascinating one, the idea that all of these other well-adapted species, and by well-adapted I mean to persistently cold conditions. In many cases, think of woolly mammoth and woolly rhino and so on, famous beasts. They all disappeared. And was it because of people? Was it because it got warmer? Was it because of other influences? There are many theories and very little in the way of believable interpretation. And I'm very agnostic as to cause. I've thought about cause quite a bit, and I don't have a good answer.
We're going to look at that. We'll look at the history, and we're going to look at the challenges right in front of this Arctic creature and a lot of others as well. But Jim Lawler, you've got them right in your backyard there. I mean, they survived. They outlived the mastodons and mammoths and 400-pound beavers and a whole lot of megafauna. Introduce us, if you would, Jim, to the muskox. I mean, how big? What's it look like up close? What's it smell like? They call it muskox. Just give us a little introduction, Jim.
I think seeing a muskox out on the tundra, you get the impression it's bigger than it really is. Mm-hmm. The muskox in Alaska, a large bull might go 750, 800 pounds or something like that. A female would be, 150 pounds less or so.
Yeah.
So when you're standing right up close, you're surprised that they aren't bigger because they look, they look pretty massive when they're out there on the tundra.
So that's what, like 3 or 4 feet tall, something 6-7 feet long in that range?
Yeah, that's about right.
Of course, when 800 pounds is charging at you, you will be quite aware of its mass, on the other hand.
Yeah, exactly. They're the, there's the stocky body creatures. So, you compare them to a caribou or something, which you also see on the tundra, and they're very light on their feet, and they're leggy, and they're, kind of bouncing across the tundra. And mm-hmm. then you see this very blocky animal with their long guard hairs, reaching down to the ground. It looks like a great big skirt and just dragging along. And so that's a very different impression, I guess.
And they stand their ground, Jim. They're famous when threatened for forming this circle or semicircle around their young. How's that work? What provokes it?
Definitely. They're known for that particular trait, that behavioral trait. You can get them, if you push them, you can get them to run, but they'll run for a little while, and then they'll turn and face danger, and they'll form up in a circle. And once you get them kind of formed up into a circle, occasionally they'll run out and charge and try to get at whatever's threatening them, whatever predator or person is trying to threaten them, which it sounds like the cameraman found out.
Right, he did in a hurry. In your view, Jim, what makes them so sturdy? What makes them so durable?
Approach to life and to life in the Arctic is I guess, endurance. They have a very conservative lifestyle. They, tend to focus in one area. They're, in terms of efficiency of digestion, they're very, very efficient digesters. The metabolic rate slows down some in the wintertime so that they can more efficiently make it through the winter. They're very good at converting low-quality food, grass, into protein, into fat to make it through the winter. So they've just got a very conservative approach to life in the Arctic.
And Ross, they've famously been through some real what people call population bottlenecks, when their numbers dwindled down next to nothing, and yet they came back, Ross.
Yes, this is, I think, one of the most fascinating parts of the story. Modern muskox, that is to say ones that are still with us, are very, very genetically homogeneous. It's the usual story that's a bad thing, that species need to be variable so that they can handle the different effects of, say, climate change going on right now or anything else that they meet up with. It's sort of like an insurance policy. But what we find with living muskoxen is that they're not exactly clones, but they are so amazingly similar that there's only one explanation. And that explanation is that they had to have had a very severe pinch on their populations. We mm-hmm. estimate that happened about 10,000 years ago, which would be very consistent with the time when all of these other megafauna were going down. Now, to amplify that story, it's just as fascinating to me, because somebody being interested, as I am, in how extinction occurs, we can actually reach back in time with a technique known as ancient DNA. And very simply, what this means is that in well-conserved material, like bones and teeth from muskox and woolly mammoth and so forth that we find in permafrost conditions, we can actually find evidence of the DNA that was hosted in the animal. And by interpreting that, we get an idea of many different things. But the one that I want to focus on is that in studies that have recently been completed, we've got now a very good gauge for the last 40-odd thousand years of what what muskox populations were like.
40,000 years. That's a long time.
Doubtless we have even more, but 40,000 is the limit of radiocarbon dating.
Okay.
And what we're finding is that it was like a roller coaster for these guys and probably for a lot of the other megafauna as well. It was just up and down all the time. Now, muskox have survived, but they still have this pattern. Dr. Lawler is certainly one to talk about this, where they have had, even within the last couple of centuries, times of great, very large population size for this species in northern Canada in the Arctic Archipelago, followed by collapse, followed right now by an emergence of a very large number of animals, particularly in the Western Arctic.
Ross, hold that thought. We've got to take a short break here. Yeah. There's a lot going on in the Arctic. Listen right here. Here's David Attenborough again with the muskox. This is from Planet Earth, right there on the Arctic, with their young enduring a harsh blizzard.
Even in spring, winds chill to the bone. The calf must stay close to its mother to avoid getting lost in the sudden blizzard.
Hear that little sound of the very young muskox right there. We're thrilled to be talking about them today, to be talking at a time of great change in the Arctic, and we'll look at that as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the musk ox, of all things. It is the great historic survivor of the Arctic, so far anyway, and hopes in the middle of a boomlet right now, maybe more than that, that can go on in spite of all the change going on up there, and it is tough change. Jim Lawler is with us this hour from Fairbanks, Alaska, biologist with the National Park Service's Arctic Network, knows all about musk ox, up close and personal. Ross McPhee is with us from the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and it's great to have him with us as well. And Jim, Ross, we're getting a lot of interesting response here. Sam writes in on Facebook, I was in the Brooks Range of Alaska, of course that's way up north, this summer on the Noatak River. We saw quite a few musk oxen, including one that walked right up to my tent and stuck its nose inside the tent flap. Absolutely massive animal, well-intentioned too, but if you scare one, you don't want to be in its way as it tries to flee or charge. Check out the photo gallery and the video of one charging a cameraman at our website, onpointradio.org. Let's get to our callers. Ryan in Canton, Massachusetts. Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I had a question for guests on your show. I was wondering if the muskox is a ruminant animal and if it was related to bovine and modern-day cows in any way.
Great question, Jim. Is it ruminant? Yes, tell us about that. And it's kind of in its own category. Who's it related to on the other question, Jim?
It's a Caprinae, and it's, so it kind of fits an in-between category, I guess. It's actually lumped with the sheep and goats, but even the scientific name for it it's Ovibos muscatus, so they kind of hedged their bets, and they when they originally named it and weren't quite sure if it was in the sheep family, sheep and goat family, or the cow family.
But it's not an ox.
It's actually sheep-goat family.
Okay.
And Ross might be able to speak more to that from the genetic standpoint. They're kind of their own distinct category.
Ross, it's not an ox despite the name.
That's perfectly true. That goes back to when the Royal Navy was trying to figure out how to get through the Northwest Passage when musk oxen were first identified, and they were called Arctic cattle at the time. This is back in the 1820s. Well, they're not cattle. They're not as closely related to the cow family as they are to sheep and goat. One interesting thing, and this is the only thing that I think would be worth pointing out to the listener, is that although we think of these animals as being uniquely North American, in fact, they're not in several different regards. One is that they arose in Asia, and they disappeared from Asia. They finally disappeared about 2,000 years ago. So even for the Arctic cockroach, which is a very compelling metaphor, I must say, Tom.
Big and maybe an insult. They're much more beautiful, I must say.
Perhaps so. But for some reason, and of course there are many arguments, but for some reason, they did finally disappear from northern Asia and persisted only in the Arctic archipelago and Greenland. So all of the wild herd that we have now, you mentioned at the start of the show that they're in various points over the Earth, including places that are completely outside of their range, like Spitsbergen. Those are all introduced from the North American wild herd. So it's a complicated story in the sense that they arose elsewhere, made it great at high latitude for many thousands and tens of thousands of years, collapsed down, and are now experiencing, as Jim just said, a comeback.
I have to say, I was astounded by the story of how they came back to Alaska after a century or so ago, end of the 19th century, I guess, Jim, essentially being hunted to extinction there. And what the U.S. arranged for some to be brought back, Norwegian sailors out in Greenland, capturing 19 female musk ox, 15 males. The head of that Norwegian sailors group saying there is much violence in a flock of musk oxen. That must have been some trip. They crated up, shipped to Norway, and then your colleague, I guess, Ned Roswell at the Alaska Science Forum writes that they were put on steamships. This is back in 1930, August. The hairy caravan crossed the Atlantic and passed beneath the Statue of Liberty in New York on September 15th, 1930, sort of just around the corner from Ellis Island there, shipped across the United States by train, back on boats up to Alaska, on a barge, Jim? They barely made it out to an island at the mouth of the Yukon River where they were reestablished, as the story goes, Jim, in Alaska.
Yeah, it was... pretty remarkable story, actually. I mean, very well-traveled animals from Greenland all the way across the U.S., spent some time in Vermont, and then in Alaska, spent some time in captivity before they were released on Nunavak Island, and then they just took off like gangbusters on Nunavak.
All 34 of them survived that incredible journey through New York Harbor and halfway around the world. What's the population of musk oxen in Alaska today, Jim?
Oh, gosh, we got to be 4,000-plus animals, I guess, all from that original group of 30-plus animals that came across from Greenland. So, and some of that population has spilled over, actually, into Canada now. So 4,000-plus animals from that original, just slightly more than 30 animals.
A lot of questions coming in here on how they're treated. Well, here's one from John at our website. It asks simply, does Sarah Palin shoot them? Are they huntable?
They are hunted. So with the increase in population, there's different – there's state laws and federal laws in Alaska and who gets priority to hunt musk oxen. So most populations, they had a – customary and traditional finding, so it was rural residents or Alaska natives who had a first crack at them in most places, but at least on the Seward Peninsula, where we have the highest number of animals, there's enough animals now they've started opening it up for sport hunting in some areas.
Wow.
Or for non-local residents.
Let them roam. I said, you've been out there with the tranquilizer darts, I guess shooting them just with the dart to put collars on them? How does that go, Jim? What's that like? How do you do it? Are you on a snowmobile, snow machine, in a helicopter? How's it work?
Yeah, actually, I'm. Some of my colleagues are the ones who are putting the collars on, so I'm not
okay.
doing it myself. But what the process is, you can do it in two ways. You can either use a helicopter to herd them, and then just fire a dart with a chemical tranquilizer in it into the musk oxen, or they've also had great success doing that with snow machines because, as we previously noted, they'll group up and face danger, so you can actually kind of corral them with a snow machine, and then you can dart them, and then you need to get the rest of the herd to move off, and so you need to push them off a little bit so you can get to the downed animal and process it, and then it's just a matter of getting a snug fit on that collar because there's a whole lot of fur in there that can complicate putting the collar on and make it too loose. So,
can you smell the musk on these musk oxen if you're putting a collar on them up on the tundra?
What's that?
Can you smell the musk? I mean, I guess they have a powerful odor during mating season or all the time, the males? What is that?
Yeah, it's primarily during mating season, and it's not that overpowering. I guess it's kind of it's overstated, I guess, is possibly the best way to put it. But it's, you know, the smell of a musk oxen is not that overwhelming or not that unusual in comparison to other animals. But it's certainly during the rut you can smell the bulls, but it's not a particularly offensive odor, or it's not overwhelming. Anything like that.
Here's Asti Bhatt writing us on Facebook. From my time with them in Arctic tundra, I've learned that the musk oxen don't like to be surprised. Oops, I guess not. On the other hand, it must be kind of fish in a barrel if they just circle up and stare at you when you're around them, Jim.
Oh, yeah, that's, you know, that probably contributed to their demise. You know, whalers, they attribute a lot of the reduction in muskox populations to kind of a combination of whalers bringing firearms to the Arctic in a lot of areas, along with some just bad luck and some nasty climatic events, kind of knocking the population down as it was. So the population was down already, and then the kind of coup de grace for a lot of the populations in Alaska, for example, was the introduction of firearms with whalers in those areas. So, yeah, they aren't the settled, you know, runoff type animals. They would be a very appealing target to somebody who's just looking for a quick, easy source of protein.
Sadly, it took them right down to nothing before they were reintroduced. Lots of questions here. East Lansing, Michigan. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello. Quick question. A fact I learned from TV documentary, I'm quite certain that muskox had been domesticated and for their wool primarily, so that might answer some of the smell question. Could you speak to that domestication by the Inuit, or not to be derogatory, the Eskimo or any other aboriginals? Thank you very much. Very interesting show. Keep it up.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks so much. Ross McPhee, what about it? Domestication by Inuits or others?
Well, yeah, domestication, but let's not go too far with that word.
Mm-hmm.
They can be relatively docile, particularly out of rut season. What we're after, however, is the wool, and that's the important thing. And in places like Banks Island in northern Canada,
where there's a very big population,
or Coronation Gulf, it's been a business. It's been a business now for probably upward of 40 or 50 years, umingmak, as they call it. And they make lovely, lovely things.
Scarves from that very, very warm, super warm underlayer of that wool.
There is no man-made fiber that even approaches it. I got my wife a scarf on Banks Island a few years ago, and she still has it and loves it because it is so exceptionally warm.
How do you harvest that? I mean, you don't have to hunt them to harvest that, I hope.
No, you don't. Although this is another part of it. There is a kill every year run by the Inuit in Canada, and they prepare meat products that are sold elsewhere and all of this sort of thing. And I think the thing to appreciate is that it is a well-run kind of business. Everyone up there understands that you don't want to kill off the golden goose sort of thing. And they're very careful in their maintenance of the wild herd, and I'm sure it's the same thing in Alaska.
Let's go to Jane in Lake Placid, New York. Jane, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Tom, you give the best show on the air.
Ah, you rock, Jane. Thanks.
Greatest show. Just fantastic. I am a horse lover. This animal is smaller than a horse, is it?
Well, smaller than a draft horse, a big draft horse, certainly. But 800 pounds, it would be horses smaller than that, I guess. So smaller than some.
1,200. Horses are 1,200.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you're quite right then.
I wonder, they must be broad at the shoulders.
They are enormous at the shoulders.
Of course, they're not as big under all that wool as they look.
I mean,
what about it, Jim? If you get underneath the wool, what's it look like in there?
Well, they're very muscular, you know, across the shoulders and things like that. So they certainly don't have the slim build, and they a lot of mass packed into a small area, which also fits into their conservative lifestyle. They aren't the long leggy thing to expose a lot of of surface area to cold conditions. So, so she's correct. They're real blocky and short-legged and barrel-chested type animal.
And Jane, you've got a question there as well?
Yes, you're getting sympathy for this animal, and I want to know how it's going to do with global warming.
We're going to get a big answer to that, but let's begin to take it on right here. We're going to hear in just a moment from Brendan Kelly, who's all over that subject. But Jim, first to you. I mean, you've got warming in the Arctic, global warming affecting things in a big way up there already. It's got a famous history as a survivor globally. What's it look like? How's the muskox face that future?
Well, you know, if you look at muskox, and you know, one thing to remember is Alaska's the southern. One of the more southern locations of their distribution. So they're
incredible.
An Arctic, what they call an Arctic obligate species. So the other ungulate or large herbivore that you think of when you think of the Arctic are caribou or reindeer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually look at the distribution of caribou, they get all the way down to Idaho, for example. Musk oxen, on the other hand, the southern extent of their distribution is Alaska and Nunavak. So
they're also up in Anwar on the North Slope, I guess.
Yeah, which is, you know, a little farther north than Nunavak.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, we're at the southern end of their distribution. So things like the cold temperatures don't bother them. It's more things like snow or rain on snow events. You know, we've already talked some about their short legs. They don't do very well about dispersing out from areas. If you get a heavy snowfall in an area, it's a challenge for muskoxen to get out of there. With their short legs, they aren't very good at cratering or digging through the snow.
So they like it cold and dry, but what does global climate change mean on that front? More snow or less? I mean, we hear less ice, but what about snow and wet?
Well, actually probably more ice because the Arctic tends to be very cold and dry, so when temperatures start warming up, you have a tendency to start getting more of these rain on snow events, which is not very good for many Arctic ungulates or herbivores at all. So that's a challenge. If you get an icing event that ices everything over, makes it a real challenge for ox to get down to their food. Same with increases in precipitation. So a lot of the climate models looking at northern Alaska and the Arctic in general predict that we'll get an increase in precipitation in northern Alaska anyway, which would not probably not be the best thing for muskox.
They sort of like Arctic desert, cold and dry. We're going to hear from Brendan Kelly from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in just a moment. But Ross, how about it? You know, Jane likes them, and she wonders what their future looks like with climate change.
I'm glad that Jane likes them. I think everybody should like muskox. Well, I'm a little bit more optimistic, perhaps, than a lot of people because my perspective is deep time rather than events going on right now. And although you wouldn't believe it, perhaps, depending on where you're hearing this show, but nevertheless, we are still in what we call the Quaternary Ice Age, which began a little over 2 million years ago. And what this looks like, in fact, is periods of intense cold with expanding ice caps. The last one covered virtually all of Canada, for example, and hit the northern tier of the U.S. But then they retreat, and you get conditions that are as warm or, in some cases, even a little bit warmer than they are today. And my point here is that the muskox, just like the polar bear, made it through these times. So it's not a nice picture because, of course, we're making everything change so rapidly. But I'm going to say they're going to survive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour, unbelievably, very happily, about the musk ox, the great historic survivor of the Arctic, so far anyway. We're asking what happens with it and more in our time of climate change. It has been incredibly durable, enduring over not just centuries, we're talking many, many, many thousands of years. When mastodons bit the dust and woolly mammoth and giant sloth and big saber-toothed cats and all the rest, the muskox has endured. Here's a little more from the great David Attenborough in BBC's The Planet Earth. We're a lone wolf here stalking a herd of musk oxen.
Arctic wolves. In the whiteout, the threat is almost impossible to detect, but the musk oxen instinctively retreat to higher ground.
Arctic wolves, you've got to love it, but the musk oxen know how to deal with the wolf and a whole lot more. We've been very happily joined from up in Alaska by Jim Lawler with the National Park Service Arctic Network there in Fairbanks, by Ross McPhee from the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Well, you'll see lots of dioramas with the Pleistocene creatures no longer around, muskox with us. We're joined right now as well from Seattle, and very happy to be so, by Brendan Kelly. He's a research biologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Marine Mammal Laboratory based in Juneau, Alaska. Has been looking at what's going on with species hybridization and loss of biodiversity in Arctic species. Brendan Kelly, thank you very much for being with us.
It's nice to join the discussion, Tom.
Now, we know, and you've been telling us, it's getting to be a weird time up there. Polar bears, what, hybridizing, interbreeding with grizzly bears as climate changes. What's going on, Brendan? I mean, do you really see the pressure on? And what about the muskox in that scene?
Well, the question of hybridization that we've recently raised is really a kind of a challenge to our scientific colleagues to take a second look at this issue. So hybridization between polar bears and grizzly bears has received a lot of attention recently.
And it's happening. You're talking about sort of spotted or, I don't know, khaki-colored polar bears who have hooked up with grizzlies.
That's right. And in fact, the most recent example that was confirmed was a second-generation hybrid. In other words, the mother of the hybrid bear herself was a hybrid. So, you know, and you end up with this difficult category. How do you treat a hybrid from a conservation perspective?
Is it related to climate change, Brendan? Is that why it's happening?
Well, that's exactly the million-dollar question. And, you know, initially, most biologists would say, well, no, this isn't related because, you know, we know hybridization occurs in animals like this from time to time. But when we surveyed the literature, we found quite a few Arctic marine mammals for which we have evidence of hybridization, in some cases well-documented from DNA data. And at the same time, we recognize that we're losing Arctic sea ice. It's diminishing quite rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And that continental-sized piece of ice is not only a habitat for some marine mammals, but it's also a barrier to their movement. And it has isolated populations for thousands of years that are rather abruptly going to have the opportunity to come back together and potentially interbreed.
So polar bears being pushed south, or grizzlies being able to go further north? What's happening on that front?
Yeah, good point. Well, they've already overlapped over considerable amounts of their range, and the amount of overlap is increasing as polar bears are forced to spend more and more time on continental margins because of the loss of ice, and the habitat is getting even better for grizzlies. So they're spending more time in the same areas, and certainly has the potential to increase the frequency of hybridization.
Does it matter if it hybridizes? I mean, is there some threat to? I'm not sure how to think about that.
If you're
I don't know, a species purist, maybe it's not Snow White anymore. Well, that sounds like a big deal. That's part of their polar bear's whole survival. But then if ice is, I don't know how to think about hybridization.
Well, I think we all need to consider that carefully. In some cases, hybridization can, actually increase biodiversity. You can end up with a third species if the parental species, as it were to persist. But in other cases, particularly if one species is very reduced in numbers for whatever cause, then you can hybridizing into another species can be the sort of the final death knell, if you were, of that species. And so, if you imagine polar bears becoming greatly reduced in numbers because of diminished sea ice habitat, then the threat of hybridization with grizzly bears is very different than if they were to remain populous and occasionally hybridize. So there isn't a simple, yes, it's good, no, it's bad answer, but in some circumstances, it could lead to very undesirable results like the loss of a species.
Or just khaki-colored polar bears. Yeah, lots of questions here for everybody. Equo in Draycott, Massachusetts. Equo, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I was recently reading the book Earth by Bill McKibben.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, Bill McKibben addresses many of the calamities associated with climate change. And one thing in specific is he suggests that mammals, as a general trend, are going to tend to get smaller as a way to adapt to climate change. I believe because smaller animals in general have larger proportional surface area to body mass.
Yeah.
And my question is, given the genetic homogeneity of the muskox, as you suggested, do you think that the muskox is going to be able to get smaller and to deal with a warmer climate?
That's interesting. I don't know. Ross, let me come first to you with that one. Are we going to see shrinking muskox, or do they not have enough, diversity to have mini musks out there to breed with and shrink down?
Tom, you got to stop this.
Okay,
mini
okay.
Musks.
Sorry.
No, I think the caller raises an extremely interesting point. But what I'm going to say is that it's not a situation where one size fits all. Yes, climate is changing. Absolutely no question. And it's occurring at a precipitous rate and was, for that kind of reason, it's mm-hmm. going to have huge impacts going forward. But my guess is that for at least some of these species, things are not going to change locally so much that they have to make really radical adjustments. Now, I'm not purposely trying to be controversial mm-hmm. here, but mm-hmm. It's not the case, for example, that with polar bears that, as Brendan was pointing out, hybridization is not a moral question. It happens all the time between species that are closely related. Polar bears, as we know from ancient DNA evidence, arose out of brown bears, perhaps on more than one occasion. So what we're seeing at work, in fact, is the enormous plasticity that's involved with species and their evolution.
Though it's at least an aesthetic question and the kind of a hubris of humans, of painting them tan with our carbon emissions seems like a sort of messing around with the palate at the very least.
Absolutely. And people need to be fully and completely aware of what we're doing. But looking at it biologically, which is mm-hmm. where I'm coming
yep.
from,
yep.
hybridization by itself is something that happens in nature all the time. And in fact, a lot depends on your definition of what a species is as to where you draw the boundary. So my guess is that muskox are in fact not going to get very much smaller. They may well contract, and this is a different kind of problem now, contract to those few areas where the living conditions are actually appropriate for them. If it continues to warm in northern Asia, for example, it's quite possible that introduced population is going to get pinched out again, and that would be a bad thing.
Jim, I want to get the Alaska perspective on that, but Brendan Kelly, first to you. You've been thinking some about musk oxen and the seasonality of the biological processes, and if the seasons are shifting, could that have an effect on musk ox?
Well, potentially on musk ox and a lot of other animals, and so one of the things that is of concern, and Ross mentioned the precipitous rate of the changing climate, and that rate is really important because for organisms to adapt, whether it's changing body size or changing the timing that they have their calves and hence can match when the plants are most nutritious, really depends on the rate of environmental change relative to the generation time of the organism. So if there's a really, really rapid environmental change, that's very hard for there to be an adaptive response. There can be adaptive responses if the change is sufficiently slow that several generations can sort of catch up with it genetically, if you will.
But isn't there calving time, the muskox calving time, timed to what plants are available to forage on at that time, Brendan?
Yeah, there's some interesting work that in caribou and muskox and the timing of calving sort of matches the point with which plant are most nutritious for the young animals. The plant phenology, if you will, the seasonal events in the plant's life is changing quite rapidly with the warming temperatures. And there is great concern whether organisms like musk oxen and caribou can sort of keep up with that change, or will there be a mismatch such that the calves will be trying to eat less plants when they're less nutritious.
Jim, I'm going to come to you on that. Sandy in Georgetown, Kentucky. Sandy, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hello. Yes, my husband and I took a trip to Alaska several years ago.
Uh-huh.
We visited a musk ox farm up in Alaska north of Anchorage.
Okay.
And one of the things that they do in their fields, they raise the musk ox and they have the brushes like they have on street sweepers.
Okay.
The
okay.
musk ox can scrape their backs on that and they can gather their wool that way. as they shed the wool. When we did our tour, there was a tuft of wool on the ground.
Yeah.
One of the tourists picked it up. The tour guide actually took that from them because it's so precious. They save every little bit of it. That wool is then dispersed to several different indigenous peoples that are in way outlying remote areas. They make yarn from it, and then they knit those wonderful scarves and things. It's called Kiviute. And then they sell them. And each one of these different groups of people, tribes, I guess, or clans, whatever, has a different pattern specific to their tribe. You can't buy the pattern or anything, but you can go to Umingmak, you mentioned that before,
mm-hmm.
and purchase that. And it just was really, really interesting to see that process and know that in Alaska they're trying to help the locals there, if you will, to be able to use that as an industry, and then you can purchase it yourself, and it's wonderful. I did buy what they call a smoke ring, which is like a little cowl thing that goes around your neck. Wonderful, wonderful.
Warmest material on earth, we're told, Sandy, and I appreciate your call. One more, Mona from North Oxford, Massachusetts. Mona, you're on the air.
Hi. I not only believe in musk ox, I have petted one.
Okay.
More than 20 years ago in the Fort Defiance Park Zoo in Tacoma, Washington.
A musk ox in a petting zoo. I feel a little sorry for that particular ox, musk ox.
Well loved.
Okay.
There was a sign. I think there were other ones there too, but the one that was near the fence was the one that was eminently pettable. There was a sign saying that she liked being petted and she liked being fed treats, but please do not touch her horns because musk ox apparently are very sensitive to having their horns petted.
And why not? I mean, a little dignity for the musk ox here. But I appreciate your call very much, Mona. Jennifer's writing on the Facebook. She said they may be smelly now and then, but look at the baby in the video. There's some wonderful photography at the website. Absolutely precious, she writes. And we've got a caller from Alaska, your neck of the woods, Jim. Let's go to Fairbanks, Alaska, and Hugh. Hugh's calling. Hi, Hugh. You're on the air.
Yes. How are you?
Pretty well. What do you know, Hugh?
Oh, well, I spend a fair amount of time with muskox, and actually as a photographer, I do still photography in the Arctic. And I'm actually sitting here with my Kiviute hat on. And the point that I wanted to make was that I've heard the under hair of musk ox and the Kiviute referred to as wool.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's not wool. It's a hair. It's a much finer fiber than wool.
Okay.
So the native people who spin the Kiviute into yarn and then weave it into things like hats and scarves, it's the finest fiber known to man in the world. It's better than alpaca and vicuña.
And how do they look when they're out in the wild? You're an Arctic photographer up in Alaska, in Fairbanks. How do they look when you see them out there on the tundra or the island?
They look like square cows. They are very blocky, and as Jim Waller said, their skirts, their long guard hairs hang right down to the ground. So when the guard hair grows throughout the entire life of the animal. So the guard hairs get very long. They never shed them. The underhair, the Kiviute, is shed every year. So I pick it up, actually, off the tundra when I'm out photographing. And I have a box. I have probably 10 or 15 pounds of Kiviute.
Wow.
I'm saving. I'm hopefully going to find somebody someday to spin it into yarn for me and then make something out of it.
Oh, lucky you, Hugh. There in Fairbanks, Alaska, thanks so much for calling. Jim, here's a question from Vermont. A dairy farmer there says, you know, they sound terrific. Could he raise them in the lower 48? What about it, Jim? What's their range?
Yeah, currently they aren't distributed that far south, but, you know, we already mentioned that the muskox that eventually ended up in Alaska spent some time in Vermont, and there's actually somebody in Montana who has some muskox and that they're raising in Montana. You know, and that kind of gets back to the point we've heard a couple times about domestication. One of the primary ideas and reasons for reintroducing muskoxen back to Alaska, besides for hunting, was for domestication, and Ross already mentioned, you know, that's a relatively, you got to be careful how you use that word, because it's essentially a wild animal that's kept in captivity. But you know, a number of callers have
mentioned that it, you know, that you can think of, in some cases, muskoxen as a cottage industry where you're actually growing and producing kvyat.
Jim, we've just got another minute here, and I'm dying to ask you, because my personal preference is to see them beautiful, healthy, and wild. How are they doing? I mean, your people are out, you know, watching them up close. We've got climate change. They're out there. We know they're great survivors, but how do you see them doing right now in Alaska?
They're going great, depending on where you are. So on the North Slope, the population isn't going that well. We've actually seen a pretty substantial crash in that population in the last 7-8 years.
Why?
But the Seward Peninsula, they're still growing at a relatively rapid rate. So depending on where in the state you go, different answers. The ones up in Arctic Refuge and on the North Slope, kind of a combination of bad luck and bad weather, and so they had some icing events. We've already talked about those, mm-hmm. and the calf production just dropped off the map, and then they had some bears that got very effective, some grizzly bears got very effective at killing musk oxen, and it looks like there's some indication that there's some mineral deficiencies, copper deficiencies affecting some of the population.
Jim, we're out of time, but we've got the picture. Ice and bears and mineral deficiencies and climate change, but these are great survivors, and boy, do we love looking at them, and boy, do we wish them well. Jim Lawler in Fairbanks, thank you so much for joining us today, Jim. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you all.
Ross McPhee at the Museum of Natural History, thank you, Ross, for your time.
You're most welcome. Lovely show. Thanks.
And Brendan Kelly in Seattle. Thank you so much, Brendan.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Go Muskox. This is On Point.